You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Heroes get remembered.
Here's the windup.
Legends never die.
Fastball hit deep to right.
Welcome to Hardball.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Major League Baseball's history in first person. Conversations that span almost 20 years.
It is 9:46 p.m.
with the men who saw and made that history.
Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch.
Many of whom are no longer with us.
Swung on and missed a perfect game.
Stories from the 1930s. To the 21st century.
That ball is going to be.
This is Hardball.
Dad, you want to have a catch?
Welcome into Hardball. My name is Chris Domino, and this is our continued trek through the history of Major League Baseball, one conversation at a time. For those of you who have listened to an episode or two, or hopefully three, thanks for coming back today. For those of you who have just found us, thanks, and I hope after you listen to today's episode, you go back and find a few others that might interest you. Here's what I hope you find out if you don't know. It doesn't matter who the subject of a specific episode is, I promise you will hear about their teammates, their cities, their opponents, and stories that seem to at times come from beyond the left field wall. The history of some of these men, very much including today's guest, reflect the times not only that they played in, but lived in. Many of these gentlemen will speak of their childhoods, and remember, for some, that means the 1930s, 40s, and certainly 50s, when they speak of how they got from small town anywhere to recalling and telling us about their first day in the bigs. I hope the social aspect of American history is not lost on you. As I say before every one of these are firsthand accounts, conversations, not interviews, that hopefully feel like the three of us, me, the guest, and you, have pulled up chairs and became new old friends. Before I tell you about how I connected with this Hall of Famer, I want to ask that if you enjoy what you hear today, could you take a few minutes and maybe tell a friend or two, a baseball fan or six? And if you can hit the subscribe button on whatever platform you are listening on, you'll be alerted when a new episode drops. Lastly, if you listen on Apple or iTunes, can you rate and maybe write a quick review? Been told that that does help more people become aware of Hardball. As we have relaunched this series, there are new episodes, those that have not been published yet, like this one, and others that go as far back as 23 years, and some that I am recording as we speak. Players who played with and against Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, Hank Greenberg and Jackie Robinson. Soon to come, my conversations with Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Ted Williams, Bob Feller, and more. Greats from the 1930s and the 21st century, and every decade in between. An attempt to have these men tell some of their story, many of them 20 to 40 years removed from their playing days. I've had the incredible good fortune to meet, then sit down with some of the greatest to ever play the game. Most of all these things, these moments and conversations stay with me. I can tell you the name of the hotel I met Rachel Robinson in 2009 in St. Louis, how we sat in the lobby and talked about the Brooklyn my father told me about in a time before I was born. I can tell you about sitting in the home dugout in Yankee Stadium with Braves pitching coach Leo Mazzoni at the 1996 World Series. 5 hours before game time, how like school children we snuck across the field and knew we shouldn't be in there, but couldn't help ourselves, as we spoke of who else had sat in this, and I quote, exact same spot over the last 75 years. I can distinctively recall the nerves that came with knowing that the next day I was going to be speaking with Ted Williams. It would turn out to be one of his last conversations with an outsider before his passing. The strange thing is, truth be known, I don't have much recall from many things these days. I can do the basics, wife, kid's birthday, my anniversary, but outside of my two daughters' milestone moments, which I probably enjoyed much more than they did, not much seems to have stuck, except for these meetings and conversations. I bring this up because, like many people this past week, it was time to recall time spent with or time spent seeing Brooks Robinson, whether in person or on the playing field. Seeing him play, hearing him call Orioles games, to watching how he lived his life after his days in uniform were done. I met him in Atlanta, and of course he was doing good work, raising money for the Baseball Alumni Association. We sat in a dugout at Georgia Tech's baseball stadium, and of course this was after I was introduced to and amazed by the fact that 500 home run hitting Harmon Killebrew was my size. Hell, I was bigger, except for my forearms. Amazingly, before I could ask Brooks anything, he asked me about my baseball fandom. When I told him I grew up in Staten Island in a very big Met house, I could see the look on his face. When I explained that the 1969 World Series were and are my first sports memories, but not knowing that the six-year-old in me would not fully understand what history would say about that season and series until much later, he stopped me and deadpanned in what was still a distinct small-town Arkansas aw shucks way. I wasn't very good in that one. I hope you watch the next year. I was a whole lot better. And that was the beginning of a 20-minute or so conversation that never included a brag or a boast from the man that had become as associated with his team and city as any other in sports and beyond. I won't go through his numbers, his accolades, too many to list. His first ballot Hall of Fame induction in 1983 says it all. Who he was as a man, a father, an ambassador for Baltimore in the game? Many are in a much better position to do so than me, and this week they did. I just wanted to share with you a quick conversation with Mr. Oriole. I have another one that I will put up at a later date, perhaps with my conversations with both Earl Weaver and Jim Palmer to create a Baltimore Oriole episode. I just thought it would be nice to hear his voice, and to all Orioles fans, I am sorry for your loss. To all baseball fans, I am sorry for our loss.
Brooks Robinson, left field, Carbo, going back, warning track, looks up, over. Brooks Robinson has given the Orioles the lead with a home run, and it's 4-3 Orioles.
Didn't need a candy bar named after him because all the people in Baltimore named their kids after him.
When you get to the big leagues, you know, you got to get here, you got to stay here, you got to figure out how to get better, and then you got to decide who you want to be like. And for all of us, you know, who knew, you know, we knew him, he was the best.
one third baseman, Brooks Robinson.
Well, a gentleman had a great opportunity in the past to speak to a couple of times, and we do it again tonight. Well, because he's one of the most talked about players in Major League Baseball history. He is Mr. Brooks Robinson. Mr. Robinson, how are you this evening?
I'm doing fine, Chris. Thank you.
We appreciate your time.
Nice to be with you.
Is it strange? I just mentioned there are certain players and baseball players are loved, liked, disliked, depends upon who they play for, depends upon who you root for. But universally, there is a couple of guys, a handful of guys, who go down as maybe just never being in that unlike category, and I would certainly put you in that category. Can you believe, going back to 1955 to the present, that might be the case?
Well, that's awful nice of you. I like to think so. I've enjoyed being a baseball player. I've enjoyed the fans. The press has been good to me. And so really, you know, I try to make people smile a lot, feel good about themselves, and that is kind of the way my philosophy is.
Was it always that way? And the reason I ask that, because I know there's pressures that baseball players talk about today. There was pressures back then, especially when you're talking about people wanting your job with as many minor leagues as each team had. Did you make a conscious effort to be a guy who would be available?
Not really. I guess it's kind of your background you grow up in. Maybe your parents have a lot to do with it, but it's never been something I tried to do. I just enjoy life and have a pretty positive outlook about everything and just kind of go from day to day.
Well, again, you were talked about in that vein, so I just wanted to let you know
Thank you.
As a baseball fan. Now, growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, I never knew this. You went to high school, and your high school did not have a baseball team.
That's correct. Yeah, I went to the largest school in Arkansas, Little Rock Central, and we had what we call the Big Seven, with the six or seven largest cities in Arkansas, like Hot Springs, North Little Rock, Pine Bluff, Texarkana. And we had what we call the Big Seven, but they did not have baseball. They had football, basketball, and track. And I really played all my baseball after school was out. I played my last 4 years of American Legion baseball, and we had a great program there. We went to Altus, Oklahoma for a big tournament every year over to Memphis, Tennessee. So we had some outstanding teams and got to travel, and it was real nice.
Now, is it true, though, were you really discovered, obviously playing American Legion ball, but were you discovered in a church league?
Well, I played I played a lot of softball, baseball when I was growing up, and I did play for Capital View Methodist Church there in Little Rock. They had a team in a church league, so I did play church league ball. I don't know if I was discovered there, but I did play softball in a church league, and I was playing in two or three leagues all the time.
Did you ever notice when scouts would actually come around? Were you aware that there might be people in the stands such as that?
Oh, yeah. We knew who all the scouts were when we played Legion ball. There were a lot of them. Several of them lived there in Little Rock. They all also had what they call bird dogs. A big-time scout might hire a person in Little Rock to look out for any good players who might come that way. So they call them bird dogs. But I knew two or three players. Gentlemen like that who were always in the stands, and I saw them around, knew them and everything, and so I had a chance to sign with about seven or eight teams when I graduated from high school back in 55, and it really came down to Baltimore and Cincinnati as to who I would sign with. And I went with Baltimore because they had a bad team, and that was they convinced me that was the quickest way to the big leagues. And consequently, it was well-founded because I got a chance to play a couple weeks when I was 18 in the big leagues. But I made the right choice in that regard.
Now, is it nerve-wracking as a 16-year-old if you look over a shoulder or as you're walking out to third base or stepping into the batter's box knowing that there are scouts around?
I never did think too much about that, to tell you the truth. I knew that many years ago that's all I wanted to do was be a big league baseball player. And when you're 14 or 15 or 16 years old, you're always pretty presumptuous, and I think you say, well, you know, I'm going to be a big league baseball player. That's all there is to it. And little did I realize that the fatality rate was pretty enormous for players who sign. I think less than 3% or whatever make it to the major league of players who sign. So, but I never thought of those things. I kind of tagged along after my dad. He was an outstanding semi-pro player there in Little Rock, and I was a bat boy for two or three of the teams that he played on, but that was always my dream. In the eighth grade, I wrote a booklet called My Vocation, or what I wanted to do. I wrote it on being a professional baseball player. And I kind of knew the history of the game and I can remember in 1948 when Babe Ruth died, cut out the clippings and put it in the back of my scrapbook. And incidentally, tonight I'm having dinner, actually, with Babe Ruth's daughter here in Baltimore. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Well, Julia Ruth Stevens, I believe.
She's going to be here tonight, and some of the people from the Babe Ruth Museum are going down to have dinner with her, and I'm one of them.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
I've had the great pleasure to speak to her in the past, and I know she did write a book fairly recently about her time growing up as Babe Ruth's daughter.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And Mr. Brooks Robinson again tonight. Now, Brooks, I'm going to say this jokingly. Did you crush him in the contract negotiations when you were signing?
Yeah, I really crushed him. You know, we signed at a period, everyone back in the 50s signed at a period where if you received more than $4,000, you were declared a bonus baby, and you had to go directly to the major leagues for 2 years, whether you played or not. And I have yet to see anyone come out of high school outside of maybe a pitcher and be able to play in the big leagues. But no one offered me a lot of money. They offered me $4,000. That was my salary for the first year. And I took it and ran and ended up going to York, Pennsylvania, and really played against it was a Class B league there, and they played against players my own speed. And consequently, I think a few of the bonus players, it really in Baltimore, was giving away a lot of money at that time. They had a lot of bonus players who signed, but none of them really panned out. And it's like almost losing 2 years just sitting and watching or playing and being overmatched. So it really turned out best for me, even though no one offered me a lot of money, over $4,000. But it worked out well.
Now, growing up in Little Rock, we know that I think the most Southern baseball at that point might have been St. Louis still.
Yeah.
Who did you actually root for? You mentioned cutting out the Babe Ruth article. Were you a fan of one team in particular or a couple of players in particular?
I was a St. Louis Cardinal fan. I grew up listening to the Cardinal games on radio. Harry Carey, we were able to get the games there in Little Rock. They used to come through Little Rock every year and play an exhibition game on their way back to St. Louis. They usually played the Chicago White Sox. So I'd take a day off from school with my dad or whoever it was, and we'd go out and watch them play. And I was a big Cardinal fan. Stan Musial had always kind of been my hero, but I followed all those players. They had Al Brazel, Jablonski, Marty Marion, Shane Deese, Howie Paulette. So I recall a lot of the names. Terry Moore played center field for him, and Bobby Del Greco. So I remember a lot of those names.
Now, how interesting was it when you get a chance to not only meet Stan Musial, but I'm assuming you might have played against him in an All-Star game?
Oh, I did get a chance to play against Musial in exhibition games and All-Star games, and I see him every year now at the whenever we make it to the Hall of Fame inductions. But I was a big thrill, and I've often told him, that you were my hero. In fact, I went to Vietnam with him back in 1967, about six or seven of us. I think it was Hank Aaron, Joe Torres, myself, Musial, Mel Allen, who's passed away, Harmon Killebrew. We went to Vietnam for 5 weeks and visited a lot of hospitals and traveled the whole country doing different things, visiting the troops. So I got to know him a little bit better on that particular trip.
Were you always a third baseman?
Actually, I signed as a second baseman. I was a second baseman the last 2 years I played American Legion baseball. I pitched some, and I was an infielder. But the last 2 years, I really was a second baseman, and I signed with the Orioles as a second baseman, and about 50 games into my first professional season, they just thought in the long run third base was going to be my best position. Never possessing great speed, Third base, you don't have to worry about that. It's more of a reflex position, and that was the best suited for me, and it turned out that that was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Now, everybody talks about your glove, but how good was your arm, in your opinion?
Well, I had an average arm. I think my arm got better. I think my main asset was I got rid of the ball quicker than most third basemen. But, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, when I talk about great arms, I talk about a guy like Aurelio Rodriguez, God rest his soul. He's passed away. And Cleet Boyer or Sal Bando, those names come to mind. But I got the ball on its way, and I think my arm got stronger as the years progressed.
The short-billed batting helmet, how did that actually come about? Were you the only guy? Because I just visualize, even the footage that I've seen, your helmet always looked different. Why is that?
It was a little different. I don't know anyone else who had the short bill hat. Actually, there was a year back in around 1969 or seven, somewhere in there that they brought in the flap on the hat,
mm-hmm.
and they designated everyone who came into the major leagues would have to wear the flap. If you were already in the major leagues and didn't want to wear it, well, you didn't have to. But I figured more protection, the better off it was going to be for me, and. When the hat with the flap arrived, I started using it, but I felt like the brim was a little longer, and also the flap that protects your ear was protruded out a little further, and I found myself thinking about the hat more so than the pitcher. So I just took a hacksaw blade and I cut about an inch and a half off of the brim. I took about a half an inch off of the flap, so that's how I got the short brim hat. But I get a lot of questions about that.
Now, eventually, did the manufacturer make it shorter for you, or did you just keep doing that year in, year out?
Actually, I kept doing it year in, year out. I had the bat. I mean, you keep these helmets forever almost, but I only had three or four, I guess, in the time that I played through 77 that I used, and the clubhouse guy would take it and cut it off.
Mm-hmm. Now, 1966, a heck of a year for you, both individually and as a team. Going into that Dodger World Series, I'm assuming they were the favorite. Would that be correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I played in four, and the two we were supposed to win, we lost. The two we were supposed to lose, we won. But the Dodgers were favored. They had been there before, a lot of their players. We had one guy, I think Frank Robinson, who played in the 61 World Series. And that was it, but we were really the underdogs in that particular series. You're absolutely right.
And you spanked them.
Well, we did spank them. Not much happened. I think they ended up with the worst team batting average for a losing team in World Series history, and we had the worst team batting average for a winning team in World Series history. Probably most of the fireworks were the first game, the first inning, and Frank Robinson and I hit back-to-back home runs, and we were ahead 3-0 just like that. And the last three games... we're all shutouts. Koufax pitched the second game, and I think it was 6-0. They made 6 errors behind him. I think in the last two games, I know we're 1-0. But we received a little break, I guess you could say, with Koufax. The Dodgers had to go right down to the wire before they cinched the pennant, and mm-hmm. I think Koufax had to pitch in one of those games. So consequently, we faced Drysdale the first game, which wasn't any piece of cake, believe me. But Koufax, Drysdale had to pitch two games against us, and that was the last game that Sandy Koufax ever pitched, that second game of that World Series.
That's right. He did retire at a very young age right after that. Mm-hmm. Mr. Robinson, is there ever enough time passes when 1969 still doesn't hurt a little bit?
Oh, we think about it, but it's just one of those things, I guess. That was probably the best team I played on, and a lot of crazy things happened, but that's just the way the ball bounces. I mean, when you play four out of 7 games, anything can happen, and I think that the fact that the Mets were so bad for many, many years, no one really gave them a chance. But here's a team that won 100 games, and you win 100 games, you're a pretty good ball club. Mm-hmm. And we won the first game here, beating Seaver, and then I think Kuzman beat us 2-1, and we lost 3-1 in 3 straight up in New York. But if you're around long enough, someone's going to get you. You're going to get them. It never fails.
Now, when AstroTurf came about, did you actually perfect and I practice some way, you and Boog Powell, that one-hop throw?
No, not really. That was the first time we'd ever played on AstroTurf in 1970 when we went to the World Series, that AstroTurf in Cincinnati. But we never really worked on anything. I think the biggest question in that World Series before the series started was what kind of shoes we were going to wear, mm-hmm. regular spikes or some kind of AstroTurf shoes, and we all ended up wearing our regular spikes in that particular series. But I did make a play. I think you're referring to behind third base.
Right.
I just got in throw and one bounce to Boog Powell. No, I was trying to throw that ball all the way, but it just took a perfect op to him. And a little later, I found out that that's the best way to make those long throws. I saw Concepcion make that throw a lot of times with one hop to the first baseman.
How strange was it, AstroTurf, the first time you step on and realize we're going to play baseball on this?
Not any big adjustment. You'd take 10 or 15 minutes of fielding ground balls, and it's not any big adjustment. I think if you played on AstroTurf 160 games, you ought to get 30 hits or more a year. I don't know how you can put numbers on it, but I think that certainly the balls are just going to get through there a little quicker. I think you ought to be a better fielder. Not too many bad hops on that AstroTurf. You can charge the ball a little more recklessly and know just what kind of hop it's going to take. So I think you ought to be a better player when you play on AstroTurf.
As we finish up with Brooks Robinson tonight, Mr. Robinson, I also am curious, did you vote yourself for the All-Century team? Did you take a ballot and actually do it the way that fans did it?
No, I don't remember. I don't think we had anything to do with it, the players.
Did you look at it yourself and maybe in your head start to figure out, who would I vote for in this situation?
Well, I think I'd vote for Mike Schmidt more than anyone else. I mean, here's a guy offensively and defensively who's been a great player. And, always, people are always saying, well, who's the greatest, And my answer to that, look, the greatest is where we want it to be. If you want it to be Brooks Robinson, Mike Schmidt, Pi Trainer, Eddie Matthews, that's your prerogative. So that's kind of my standard answer. Well, who's the greatest heavyweight champion of the world, boxing-wise, and whoever you want it to be. So, it's kind of difficult to compare players and eras, I guess. And certainly the All-Century team, the players who have played in the last 40 years had a better, a big advantage over guys who played way back when. And but it was a thrill. When you get my age, any award that comes your way, that's perfectly fine with me.
Well, let's just talk about two things. As great as a career was, you hold two distinctions, I believe, that would fall onto the infamous side, probably more than a famous side. Do you still hold the record for hitting into the most triple plays?
Well, I don't think they kept records of that, to tell you the truth. Someone told me that. I probably hit into three or four or whatever. Only one of them was around the horn, and the rest of them were kind of funky plays, maybe a line drive, step on a base, get a guy to run down, something like that. But, someone told me that I hold a record for that, and I do remember hitting into three or four of them.
And what about the All-Star games? Boy, the American League really struggled for a pretty long period of time.
You're right. The All-Star game, that was got to be kind of embarrassing after a while. I think that where the National League got the jump on the American League was the fact that they signed the black players before the American League did, and when you got guys like Aaron and Mays and Clemente and Ernie Banks, you got some great baseball players. And I've always enjoyed that. I always say, well, if they'd have played like me in the All-Star games, we'd have won a few more.
Well, I will tell you, you're not the first player to tell me that, just that, about the National League getting the jump when it comes to the African-American players. And really, the American League did not pick up on it as quickly as the NL did.
That's right. I played in 18. A couple of years they had two games, I think, in 60 and 61, but we won two, tied one, and lost 15. I think that was what the final outcome was.
Well, Mr. Robinson, it's always a pleasure, and I'm not kidding. When I talk about when you were down here, I just saw the way that everybody, young and old, gravitated towards both you and Mr. Killebrew, and there is something to be said for guys who carry themselves in a way that represents baseball in such a wholesome manner.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I thank you for calling. We'll do it again sometime.
As I stand here before you, I realize I must be the luckiest man in the world. I keep asking myself, how could any one man have been so fortunate? I shall do what I can to continue to make this great game of baseball and this world finer. Better. This is a day for my giving thanks, and this is a life from which I want to give back. Thank you.
And to you friends out there, you have always been so good to me. Thank you very much.